that he, for we can assign no other basis to this teaching that is of rational psychology than the simple and in itself completely empty representation, I. And we cannot even say that this is a concept. Why can we not say it's a concept? Why is I not a concept? What do concepts do?
Unify intuitions.
Okay, and what determines the use of concepts?
Empirical reality.
So we apply to multiple instances of the same. But there aren't multiple instances of the I. There's just the usages of the I. So I is not even a concept, since it doesn't pick out any object. I does not pick out any object. When I say I don't have to ask myself which I. I'll come back to this in a moment. This is terribly important because it's unlike other pronouns. I say he went to the shop, you can ask who. It's in the corner. What? I'm thinking, and then you say to me, who? So, but only that it is a bare consciousness which accompanies all concepts. Through this I or he or it, the thing which thinks, so we don't even know what it is, we call it I, but it's simply the thing which thinks, nothing further is represented than the transcendental subject of thought equals X. It's the subject of thought, not the object. The object of thought, when I'm thinking about what I'm thinking, then I'm thinking about my empirical self, what Kant calls my inner sense, not my thinking about my inner sense. So the first paralogism states that the representation of which is the absolute subject of our judgments and cannot therefore be employed as determination of another thing is substance. I as thinking being and the absolute subject of all my possible judgments, and this representation of myself cannot be employed as predicate of any other thing. Therefore, I as thinking thing, being, soul, and substance. So that's the false argument. And the power of the false argument is that if I am thinking, I am always in the position of the thinker and never the object thought. So even when I'm thinking about my own thoughts, I'm still in the position of thinker, subject, and therefore not object. But if I'm always subject and not object, then I cannot, as it were, and this underlines all my judgments, then that which underlies all my judgments is substance. Therefore, it is natural for us to regard ourselves as as substance, as thinking, not just that, of course, our empirical selves, you know, with all my history and all that, you know, that's me, but there's something about the me-ness of me, if you want, my very I-ness, that seems irreducible. And that really exists. And the reason that I am drawn to this again is because I am always in the position of being the thinker. Now, the only way of avoiding this, just to show how bizarre it is, the only person I know who tried to avoid it was B.F. Skinner. And Skinner tried to treat himself exactly as he treated his rats. That is, he would have a rigorous schedule, and he would give himself inducements and punishments and all the like, right? And he actually, as it were, tried to cut out from the fact that he was generating this thought of treating himself as a rat. Right? But you can see, and here's the point, it's great that you laugh because the paradox of that, the craziness of Skinner, is what leads exactly to the paralogisms. No, I can't be the thing. I'm the thinker, never the thing. Right? So Skinner was trying to make himself into an object, but in doing so, he was engaging in what we might call a performative self-contradiction. He was always the performer as well as the performed.
We take the other extreme of that, because Skinner being like the hardcore materialist, and I think immediately Martin Luther, which is the hardcore objectivist, who treated himself the same way. So how would you explain that to the other?
Well, but you have to have a crazy belief to do that. Well, you have to have a belief that although you're always soul, the fate of your soul is not up to you. That's why Luther had that thought. That he was either damned or saved. So he had the idea that he was inevitably soul. But there was a bigger, there was a judge. There was a Skinner of which he was the rat. And we call that Skinner God. Well, no, I mean, I think that's what Luther is. I mean, that's what religion is, yeah.
But wouldn't Skinner's...
Not only.
wouldn't Skinner's view only be a contradiction if he somehow came to the conclusion that his behavior was not itself the effect of prior causes, socially conditioned, educationally conditioned his research? I mean, did he actually think that his behavior was not the effect of all of the causes which preceded it? Everything...
He, no, his problem was that's what he thought. He thought his behavior was only the product.
Right, so where's the contradiction? It was.
Well, one hopes not, because if he is, then he wasn't a thinker. There was
defined,
no spontaneity.
Well, so a thinker defined in terms of spontaneity and cognitive.
Yeah, he was training himself to be a rat. Right? And to make himself into nothing but the product of. So we distinguish. Think about it this way. Most of us want to distinguish between brainwashing and thinking. On your account, there's no difference. Why? Because the spontaneity of thought shows that thinking is a normative, not a causally bound activity. It's activity, right, that it's doing. This is not, again, this is the difference between intending and predicting. So Skinner wanted a world in which the self was totally predictable, without any spontaneity, without any doing whatsoever. But, of course, the thought that we are substance that temptation is no better, and Kant's argument, or the best version of it, is on A350. Where at the end of the paragraph he says, at the end of that first paragraph on the page, the I is indeed in all thoughts, but there is not in this representation the least trace of intuition. Distinguishing the I from other objects of intuition. Thus, we can indeed perceive that this representation is invariably present in all thought, but not that it is an abiding and continuing intuition, wherein the thoughts, as being transitory, give place to one another. Okay, so the thought here is, in order for the self to be a substance, a single object, there would have to be an intuition of it, right? And in that case, it would be an intuition, a noun, like any other object, right? But there isn't. So this is just the argument that although I have an invariable awareness of the I do not have an intuition corresponding to that awareness. So it follows that not everything I am aware of is an awareness of an object. Some things I'm aware of are indeed doings, and that indeed it's just this that distinguishes the I from other objects. Put it another way. The I is not a referring expression. You can't use the word I to pick out and discriminate and refer to one object as opposed to other objects. Rather, the I has a role, a function, in our cognitive activities, namely being the thinker of those activities. So the I is that which judges, again, and is not the object. Referring expressions, again, require intuitions, and therefore would require being picked out by concepts. I can teach you to use the word I, but I can't teach you to pick one out, say of a lineup. Yeah?
What about the body?
What about it?
Doesn't the I refer to the body as an object as opposed to all other objects?
Not as opposed to, because it's my body, and of course my body is different from your body, but I pick out my body as opposed to your body in complicated ways. Think about, here's an example. My point is we can make mistakes about bodies, we can't make mistakes about I. Sometimes you are lying in bed entangled with your lover, and you say, move your elbow. Your lover says, no, that's your elbow. So, now, the point is, we can reasonably ask the question about entangled bodies, whose is that? But I can ask about a thought, is that my thought?
Unless you're psychotic.
Or married.
Or brainwashed, indeed. But then, of course, you're still the thinker of the thought in a certain way. And the notion of mine, therefore, has another use. But it's in, but again, the notions of pathology are fine, right? Because they are exactly what I keep saying. It's the breakdown of unity. And therefore, you're having thoughts that do not add up and do no cognitive work, and therefore cannot orient you or give you knowledge. That's what psychosis is. That's why it's terrifying. It's representations that haunt you rather than being means of access onto the world. You're not thinking the thoughts are beating up on you. Yeah, I'm not claiming that the I think can suffer or be displaced. I'm saying it can't be confused. It's not an intuition.
I know you'd said last week that there, or at some point, there are different modes of access to the world, and in the critique of pure reason, we're looking specifically at the eye of the I think. Mm-hmm. While we can also engage the world in acting, we can engage the world in taste or appreciation.
Right.
But I worry then that when we're talking about these paralogisms of the I, if we can so neatly rule out the I of, say, the I will or the I of the I taste, because these are also experiences we have of the I, and it seems like we're exclusively working with the I of the I think. And then maybe the arguments work, but do they work equally as well in the other, say, two modes of experience? My sense is that it's more complicated.
It's more complicated, but you're still not going to lever it into an object, an intuition. On the contrary, you're even going to get more, if you wish, refined and effete notions of spontaneity. So maybe the thought might help think about it this way, that the reason, that the notion of someone at the break was mentioning Nietzsche here. It's the right analogy, in a certain way. Because what Kant is insisting about the I think is that it is solely the agent of the deed, and there's nothing underlying that. That any thought that there's a substance more than the activity itself is the mistake. Let's move to the... Yeah.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I'm just wondering, if it's not an intuition, this is certainly not a sensible intuition.
Certainly not a sensible intuition.
What does it mean to say then that there's a kind of awareness of the eye, I think, or... I mean, what weight does awareness carry if we can't have something like intuition?
I was going to say that to the very end. And maybe I can't. Kant has, in a variety of passages, a worry about just that he is aware of it as an awareness. And so let's take a look at some of the passages, since they will help us. All right, this is just as a sidetrack, but it's an unavoidable one, I think. B-158, the note at the bottom of the page. Kant says, the I thing expresses the act of determining my existence. I can see Joe's marked this up heavily already. Quite rightly. No. This foot, like all the complicated passages about the self, interestingly, are in footnotes. There's this one and the one of B422, which maybe we'll get to today. The I think expresses the act of determining my existence. Existence is already given thereby. But the mode in which I am to determine this existence, that is, the manifold belonging to it, is not thereby given. In order that it be given, self-intuition is required, and such intuition is conditioned by a given a priori form, namely time, etc. Just now talking about inner sense. Now, since I do not have another self-intuition that gives the determining in me, and now becomes a passage that Gabe, I'm sure, loves, I am conscious only of the spontaneity of it prior to the act of determination, as time does in the case of the determinable. I cannot determine my existence as that of a self-active being. All that I can do is to represent to myself the spontaneity of my thought. That is the determination. And my existence is still only determinable sensibly, that is, as the existence of an appearance. But it is owing to this spontaneity that I entitle myself an intelligence. So I am aware of the act of determining, even when I'm determining inner sense, that is my own history, my own mental life. But when I'm so doing, right, there's the side of me that is gets determined. Ah, yes, I remember the summer in Cannes, right? So I'm working on my own mental representation. I'm remembering, I'm ordering, but I am doing the determining. Now, it's this position of being the determining that never gets determined, the spontaneity of it, by means of which I entitle myself intelligence. So the reason that the subject is aware, what are we aware of? Be aware of a power of activity, of something we can do, of something we can achieve even cognitively. And we have and that awareness here, why is Kant fussing here? Because he says that awareness is different from my awareness of my inner life. So my inner life has two sides to it. The determining, my engaging in some activities of reflecting, attending, worrying about a certain memory. Why did I say that? What was the thinking? So the event in my mind and the scrutinizing of that event, the determinant of it. And it's in virtue of the latter, you say, that I think of myself as an intelligence, and therefore as not subject to, let's call it, temporal synthesis even. I'm not ordering, when I am thinking, I am ordering my thoughts temporally, but the thinking itself is not further ordered temporally. So one claim by Kant is that I'm always aware of myself as this is simply, again, the difference between being aware of subject and object, doing, not intuition. In the footnote at 422, endless, so I won't read it all. But Kant does say something really odd there. And the odd thing he says is the I think expresses an indeterminate empirical intuition. Why does he put it that way? An indeterminate empirical intuition.
Say like James said in empirical psychology, I mean it's a something, but it's not a complete something. I mean there's a focus, but then there's a fuzzy fringe around the edge of it. I mean it's something, but it's not closed.
Well, yeah, that is James's argument in principles. The question here is why. I mean that's a nice approximation. The question I would ask is why isn't it closed? Why is it fuzzy or always out of focus or something we cannot make determinate?
Is that what you suppose that it could fall into the concept?
Sure. So it's again the question of, so the reason he's calling it quasi-empirical here is because he's suffering with the thought that despite all his attempts to keep these things separate, this is something that happens at a time, even though it's not subject to time, but it happens at a time. I'm thinking now and not yesterday, so right. So it's an occurrence. It's an occurrence that is always correlated with actual empirical occurrences, what's actually going on in my mind. And it is something for which I cannot unless by some massive mistake, let's call it the Skinner thing, cannot mistake for something else. So Kant's teaching us that what this awareness is an awareness of a spontaneity. And because it's a spontaneity and not an intuition, then it's going to be quasi-empirical. So the fuzziness is both about act, not object. Therefore, it is, it's a matter of point of view. It's never what's thought It's always the thinking of the thought. And again, the thinking of the thought cannot be isolated from the thought. It's the activity of the thought itself, yeah? Gabe?
So if it's indeterminate because it's not conceptual and empirical because it's something that's actually taking place,
yeah.
Why is it a perception?
Perception is just his word for awareness.
Okay.
Don't always think that perception regards eyes. Right?
But
perception is...
Intuition? Why doesn't he say intuition there instead of perception?
Because it's not a one. If we had an intuition, we could pick it out. So he calls it a perception because we have perceptions, which are forms of awarenesses, but it's not an awareness of an object. It's exactly the thought, right? And so he's trying to get us to see the irreducibility of subject to object. This is, now, the reason why I'm pressing this, oh God, I'm running out of time. I'll put forward a proposition and we'll take it up in 2 weeks' time. The proposition is simply this. If it is true that I must consider myself an intelligence in virtue of my spontaneity, must consider myself a subject, and to consider myself a subject is to consider myself as having the power of spontaneity, then it follows that we have some knowledge about the subject that is neither noumenal ignorance nor metaphysically neutral nor an empirical proposition. That is, Kant's claim here, I think, extends beyond the claims of the Critique of Pure Reason itself. The I think gives him, let's call it, more metaphysical commitments than he acknowledges. He wants to say we know appearances only, not things in themselves, that we don't know in truth. He thinks in truth we are noumenally ignorant. We don't know what the noumena is. He thinks in truth the I think is metaphysically neutral. It's compatible with any possible system. And I'm saying that's not true. I'm saying that's not true because the one thing that it could never be is causal material. Therefore, it is more metaphysically robust than his official doctrine acknowledges. Which is why Fichte was not metaphysically neutral. Fichte took that thought, the thought of spontaneity, and this is Fichte's discovery, and said, activity is the one thing that is simply metaphysically irreducible to any material substratum. And since we must consider ourselves self-active agents, self-active is a nice Fichtean word. Since we must consider ourselves self-active, then we are always committed to some version of non-anti-materialism. So therefore, the Kantian system is not metaphysically neutral about the meaning of the world. Okay, we'll stop there. Those who want to come back after a kind of